The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Monto, Dublin's 19th century and early 20th century red light district, was once said to be the largest in Europe. However, today, I suppose not many people are that aware of its former existence, except perhaps when they hear the Dubliners' song Monto and wonder, what is Monto? Well, we're about to find out. Because there's a new book, it's called Wrong Women, Selling Sex in Monto, Dublin's Forgotten Red Light District. And also, it gives a voice to the many women who lived and worked there. The author is Caroline West. Caroline, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with the basics. I mean, claim it was the biggest red light district in Europe for a while. How big was it?
It wasn't quite the biggest, but it was the longest running and the most notorious and the most important for a lot of historical reasons. So Monto was only like 1 square mile. It was a tiny, it's like an apartment block now, basically. But in that 1 square mile, you could have 1,600 women selling sex at any one point. But then you also had the madams, the soldiers, the clients. So in the 1 square mile, you could have thousands of people every night.
How far back can you trace Monto, you know, as a district for sex?
It kind of started forming around 1850, 1860s. And the result of that was that brothels over the south side had started to be closed down and everyone kind of got pushed over. So the Victorians were really great about understanding that people need to have pleasure, you know, but they wanted to keep it out of sight. So they zoned everything.
And this kind of came in parallel with the degradation of some of the fine houses on the north side.
Absolutely, yeah. So the brothels of Monto were a real mix. So some of them, the upper class ones, were the gorgeous Georgian houses. Then you had two-story terraces, and then you had cottages, and then you had the streets as well. So it was a real mix of fortunes. You had upper class fancy brothels that apparently Prince Albert lost his virginity in. But you had all like the fancy people around Dublin. But then you had people who, their idea of a brothel was a rotting bare room in a tenement that was crumbling and their neighbours were families, you know, with maybe like 10 kids in the room.
Now, if you went to one of the high class brothels, what might you pay?
A lot. So you have to pay an entry fee. Sex was usually about £5 or £50 for the night, whereas women on the streets, you know, they'd be down to maybe a shilling or perhaps even free or a bottle of beer. So a real disparity in income. So you could rent the girls for, you know, the hour or whatever, or spend the night with them there. But you were also paying to have an experience. So the madams curated this atmosphere that was full of like really sumptuous decorations, surroundings. There was entertainment, there was music, there were people playing pianos. There's an incredible raucous kind of atmosphere for the students, or well, and students. There were medical students there who provided fake clean STI tests for the girls as well. So all of humanity was there in Monto, from royalty to the cream of crop, to our politicians, to priests, to literally everybody passed.
And the man who became king after the death of Queen Victoria, he did his military training in Ireland, or some of it, and he was a regular habitué.
Absolutely, yeah. Some of the other people who talk about him call him Dirty Bertie, which I think quite suits him. He was well known for going around all the red light district. And of course, most of the clients in Monto, they're British soldiers, because Monto backed onto the army barracks. And Dublin was such an important stop for the British Empire. So a lot of the troops would come over.
We were the
here.
Second city of the empire at
Absolutely.
The time.
Absolutely. And they were
of course,
like party
it's a port as well. So you had lots of sailors coming into a very busy Dublin port.
Absolutely. And they'd sing songs about, oh, when we get on land, the girls are going to come out and see us. And they knew what they wanted. It was drink, girls and a good time.
Now, there are all sorts of questions that this raises straight away. How were the girls recruited into Monto?
So a lot were recruited by the famine, basically. A lot of people fled Monto, fled the countryside because of the famine or family violence. There's so much incest, domestic violence, sexual violence going on, and a lack of employment opportunities and education for women. So they would kind of end up in Monto.
Now, some of them would arrive on the train thinking that they were, you know, going to get a job in service. You know, they might become a maid or whatever, but there'd be some likely lads at the trains.
Absolutely. The madams would send out their most handsome bully boys. So now we'd probably call them pimps maybe nowadays, to meet the girls and say, oh, do you want a new job? I can see, you know, that you're in need of some help and support. and some of them would away they go. And that still happens today. You know, that's trafficking when you're lying to someone about the purpose. So some of them went willingly. Some people were there absolutely pure consent, had a great time, and others were locked in their rooms by the madams. So you have real different levels of autonomy there.
Hmm. Now, the idea that some people went in willingly, there were those who said, OK, I'm going to do this for a while. I'm going to make some money and I'm going to get a new life for myself. Do we know to what extent that actually happened?
That happened a lot. Like, most sex work is really transitory. A lot of the time it's, you know, there's maybe a set goal. Maybe Christmas is coming up or something, you know, or a big bill. And, you know, you have to have that expense. So sometimes they'd go in for a few weeks and then go, or they might be there for a couple of months and then go. So it's very, very transitory. But people, you know, they were like, okay, I'll go in, I'll make money, and then I'll go and emigrate. Or they would go in and meet some of the madams who would give them fake marriage certificates for imaginary dead husbands so that they could emigrate as a respectable woman who was a widow, not a fallen woman. So I think that was really nice, doing that and giving those women a whole new life.
Now, one of the things you keep mentioning are the madams, that the houses were run by the madams. So was this an entirely female organised enterprise?
Yeah, pretty much.
Women exploiting women, if you like.
Absolutely. And the more I dug into it, the more that's the same in so many red light districts. So at the time of Monto, their contemporaries were all women running the brothels, because a lot of them were former sex workers themselves. They knew the tricks of the trade. They knew how to manage it. And they were able to navigate their way from sex worker up to madam. But they were brutal women who also built community. They were, you know, multifaceted. Like, they had no problem slashing the faces of the girls or kicking them out on the streets, because they knew they'd get more like the next day.
Now, the idea that there were different kinds of prostitutes on the streets, there were those unfortunate wretches who were trading sex for a beer or whatever it is. Then there were the higher class ones, the better looking ones the madams assembled, and they would dress them up and make sure they were perfumed and clean for the high class clientele. Mm-hmm. You have stories of they'd put them in a carriage and parade them around the place. What was that all about?
They were masters of marketing, I have to say. So there is one madam in particular called May Oblong, and she would have been one of the longest madams.
Was that her real name?
A real name, yeah. She
Oblong.
Was May Roberts at before marriage, and then married somebody, Oblong. And then, so she would get her girls, she was over 6 foot, so an imposing figure, would go around Monto in all her fancy clothes, you know, when everyone else is in rags on the street, and she was very, very glam. And she had a horse and cart, and would dress the women up super nice and parade them around town to be like, here's what the sample is in my brothel. So you
could, and everyone kind of knew what they were. They weren't kind of mistaken for highborn women.
No, they definitely were unapologetic in their wealth. They were happy to flaunt it. They went to places like the Opera, the Gaiety, the Royal Horse Show, and people, like, they kind of tolerated them, but they said, oh, we know your fabric is a little bit cheaper, or we know you're trying to be one of us, but you're not quite because you're tainted. So they were trying to be as respectable as they could, and society kind of half tolerated them, mostly because they had a lot of, like, blackmailable secrets and high class clients and everything else. So they did enjoy quite a bit of power. I mean, one of them, actually May Oblong as well, was best friends with some policeman who would spend all night in her brothel and do her bidding for her. So they really had a lot of connections in high places.
Now, sometimes, of course, clients might arrive that the women did not relish the prospect of any kind of sexual encounter. And they had this badger game. Explain what that is.
Yeah, so there's so much hustling and tricks and everything else that went on in Monto. So this was one of the techniques. So the women would be in bed with the guy, with the client, and then they'd all of a sudden get this frantic knock on the door, and it would be this rough looking bully boy who would be quite happy to conduct violence against someone and say, oh, that's my wife, what are you doing in bed with her? I can't believe you're here, I'm going to kill you. And then obviously the guy would have to scramble. He's like, okay, look, you can pay me or I'll beat you up. And of course, most of them chose to be paid and then run out of the place and never come back. But
Some of the things you mention in the book, quite remarkable, that the way these women dressed actually had an influence on fashion.
Yeah, fashion has always taken its tips from sex workers, you know, like low cleavages, the corsets, everything else. Like, women in sex work have been at the forefront. So the women of Paris, the sex workers there, influenced the madams of Ireland, and they influenced the madams of London, and then they influenced the rest of society too. So
now pink was a colour that, you know, ordinary women, respectable women, so-called, would use to suggest a delicatesse.
Yes.
You know, and then the prostitutes took that on.
Yes, they went brasher, though. So pink became a real fashion statement around the 1860s, like kind of mauve, purpley, pink topics. And when the women of Monto in London started adapting it, they went for the really brash, bright colours, the fuchsias, the real dark colours. And then the fancy upper class women went, oh, that's too much for us. So they went back to really delicate kind of pinks. So even within the pinks, there is the right pink and the wrong pink to wear. And it marked you out then as... it was a visible marker of the wrong woman. And the more visible they were, the more prone to violence they were. So a lot of people tried to blend in.
Now, the life for ordinary women, you know, looking at it externally, it seemed to be quite repressed. And you talk about in the brothel, for example, women would literally let their hair down.
Yeah, I found this absolutely fascinating, of like the rules of the convention of, you know, you could not go out without your hair done up. And I was interviewing the singer Gemma Dunleavy for the book. Her great granny was the midwife of Monto, and she had her hair tied up. And I was telling her that, and she's like, oh God, I'd never go out the door with my hair down. Never. Like, that would be unthinkable in my family. So it's still kind of carried on. So it just looks at, like, yeah, those different spaces, who we are behind closed doors and inside.
And inside, the women would let their hair down, which was seen as a kind of a wild thing to do.
It was very rebellious, you know. Yeah. It was definitely a sign that they didn't respect those rules.
Now,
yeah.
We know that ultimately the campaigning of people like Frank Duff, the founder of the Legion of Mary, led to the demise of Monto, but I suspect it was going to come anyway.
It was. It was the time period, you know, Monto started, it was in the right place at the right time. By the end of it, it was the right place, the wrong time to be shut down. So church and state had kind of combined to say, well, this is the kind of Ireland we want. We were fighting for our independence from the British. So we had to say, we're different from them. Prostitution's an English vice. We prefer our Irish women to be good Catholic Irish women, staying at home, having many babies. So it impacted.
Anyway,
Monto.
Its time was coming, but that campaign led by Frank Duff, for which he was celebrated. Now, the question of their interaction with two authorities, one, the police, and secondly, the medical profession. Now, talk to me about the police. What would happen if a woman was thought to be a prostitute and was arrested? How many arrests before jail?
Some of them had multiple arrests if they were able to pay off the fine. But the problem was sometimes the fine was 20 shillings. And so for the women who could only earn 1 shilling, that's 20 clients they then have to see. But then to keep that money, to keep 20 shillings in your pocket, or if you have no safe accommodation, it was kind of impossible. So a lot of the poorer women would end up in prison, whereas the higher class madams, they had manageresses who had the same name as them. So the police would turn up and say, oh, we're looking for Annie Meehan. And then so the helper would be like, I'm her. And she'd go to prison. And everyone knew, the judges, police, they all knew who exactly everyone was, because they were in the brothels as well, and they were clients and friends. But they just let it all slip.
And if any of the higher class of prostitutes had a major fine, some client might actually pay it.
Yeah, which sounds great on the surface, but then you wonder, what cost does that come at? You know, what's expected in return for that? Or is it the madam paying it to keep her girl out of prison? And people were very desperate to stay out of prison, or the medical system, because the medical system was absolutely brutal to these women. So
talking about protection and trying to avoid venereal diseases, including syphilis, they had condoms.
They did. They had better birth control than women in the 1930s, because contraception was banned in Ireland then. But they were able to buy rubber condoms on chemists on O'Connell Street. Sometimes they used pigs' intestines as prototype kind of contraception.
But they had condoms that they washed.
Yes, reusable condoms were the thing until kind of 1860s, 1870s, and then the disposable condom came in. But yeah, they had to wash out their condoms. But they'd also do things like douching with Listerine. Every brothel around the world has uncovered bottles upon bottles of Listerine. So they were trying their best to protect themselves.
Now, there was a situation where women might have been deliberately infected with syphilis. Explain how that went on.
Yeah, this was pretty grim. So they would go into a place called the Westmoreland Lock Hospital, which is now where the Irish Times building is, over near Tower Street Station. And that hospital was for people who had venereal disease at the time. It was called STIs. And the women would come in. They'd say, we're going to inject you with syphilis to try and find the cure. Everyone was desperate. Syphilis at this time was horrific. It was a guaranteed painful, undignified death in horrific circumstances. So the women were desperate. So they would be injected 300, 400, 500 times with syphilis from other people to see where the sores would come out on the body, to see how it was transmitted. And
was this supposed to be a voluntary situation?
It was supposed to be, but those women, I mean, what kind of choice do you have? You know, it was kind of viewed as like their penance to pay for the state taking care of them. You know, it was like the price you had to pay. The same with women going into the workhouse, the price to pay was that they donated their bodies to science. But donated is a very inverted commas. But yeah, so they would experiment on these women. They also injected them with gonorrhea from men into their arms. And they said, oh, we only inject people who already have syphilis. But that's not necessarily true, because they thought any vaginal discharge at the time meant it was syphilis. But vaginas have discharge all the time, and that's completely natural. So a lot of them maybe didn't have anything. But they were left, like their skin would rot away, and they'd say, you know, every one of their deaths was something else. So they were kind of covering it up a little bit, because if you're injected with syphilis 300 times and you have sores all over your body, that's definitely going to play a role in your deaths.
How many of them took their own lives or had their lives taken deliberately?
A lot, I think, yeah. But again, numbers are hard to find. Any bodies would have ended up in the Liffey, so either by suicide or by murder. There were lots of rumours of hidden tunnels and easy ways to dispose of women, but also nobody cared. You know, they were just, they were viewed as expendable. So committing violence against them. Smotheration. This is the whole reason I wrote the book. I read this story that when the women went into the hospital, they were smothered. They were put out of their misery with syphilis as a mercy kind of thing. So I explored what that looked like, and, you know, saw that it did kind of go on in other places. I couldn't conclusively prove it happened here, but I suspect so. But I suspect it was done as a mercy, as a kindness thing, because the women would have been suffering horrendously. But the Lock Hospital burnt all their records when they closed.
Now, there were a few women who actually appeared to enjoy the life that they had. And maybe it was in the better class of brothel, where they were comfortable and clean and as many precautions as possible. But others simply got through it by the use of, to this day, drink, drugs of various kinds. Opium was used in, laudanum was used, methylated spirits.
Yeah, and you can imagine the toll that takes on your body. And at the same time, a lot of them would have been homeless or living in extremely poor, mould-filled houses, tenements, you know, that were horrendous. So the system was really stacked against them. Like, you can't blame them for wanting to try block out some of that, because they just had such incredible hard lives. And they were also coming from extremely traumatized backgrounds, from the famine, you know, and the threat then of, like, where did they go? Did they go into a laundry? Did they go into a mother and baby home? Do they go into the brothel? You know, like, options were very limited for these
women. And you mentioned babies. I mean, abortion was common. They had all sorts of techniques.
Yeah, women pass it down through years over, like, which herbs worked. And, you know, Listerine, again, it was used in quite a lot of situations. But through the book, I found out the Granny Dunleavy actually carried out abortions as well for the women, but from the perspective of trying to save them, trying to save their lives and give them a better outcome. Because if they were going through childbirth, they could be doing that on the streets or in hallways. And then what were their options? It was a mother and baby home, or, you know, they give their babies to the local community and then leave. So they very few options in every aspect of their lives.
Now, the people who used it, not just the soldiers and the sailors, but the gentry, as you mentioned, but James Joyce.
Yeah. James Joyce, that man is, he had some interesting tastes, I think. So he was actually rumoured to have caught syphilis in Monto, which I find fascinating. So he was a regular at Bella Cohn's brothel. I have a photo of her in the book, and she ran a BDSM themed brothel. So maybe Joyce was into some of the more wilder tastes in life. But I do quote in his love letters to Nora Barnacle in the book as well. He liked some unusual things, shall we say.
Well, it's an endlessly fascinating book and a marvellous piece of research and the telling of the story. It's called Wrong Women. The subtitle is Selling Sex in Monto, Dublin's Forgotten Red Light District. It won't be forgotten any longer once people get to read your book, written by Caroline West. Caroline, thank you very much for joining us in studio today.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.